domain-driven design and clean architecture with Steve Smith.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host for helping you and your team move fast, deliver quality, and to run your software with confidence in Azure, all while using everything that the .NET ecosystem has to offer. The podcast is sponsored by ClearMeasure, a software architecture company that empowers .NET teams to be self-sufficient and able to deliver world-class results. They are hiring architects and .NET engineers who'd like a path to become an architect, so you can go to clearmeasure.com/careers for that. And if you have a comment or question for the show, send me an email at podcast@palermo.network. And also, my new online TV show has launched. You can search for, quote, Programming with Palermo, end quote, in any of the podcast directories or online. You'll find it. You can also find it, all those episodes, at www.palermo.network. And the guest on the show is a returning guest, Steve Smith, and he was last a guest on episode 48, talking about DevOps quality back then. But Steve works with companies that want to avoid the trap of technical debt by helping their teams deliver quality software quickly. Steve and his team at NimblePros have been described by clients as a force multiplier, amplifying the value of existing development teams. Steve's client list includes Microsoft, Quicken Loans, Selena Insurance, and many other satisfied customers. And he also offers career coaching to developers through devbetter.com. Steve, welcome back to the show. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Glad to be back.
Yes. It's been over 2 years since you've been on the show. What have I been doing?
It was before the pandemic when we last talked. That's a long time ago.
That's right. When you're talking through Zoom, that shouldn't be an excuse, but that's all good. Now, you've been busy since we last caught up with you, and you've published a book on architecting modern web applications. You've done some conference talks, other podcast appearances, but catch us up. Just what have you been really focusing your attention on in the last, I don't know, 3 years?
I've been doing a lot of stuff with domain-driven design in particular and architecture, how to build architecture that supports domain-driven design and avoids having your system turn into this big ball of mud that kind of falls over under its own weight because it's too tightly coupled to a lot of infrastructure and other components inside your architecture. So as microservices and, you know, other types of architecture have become more and more important these days, there's been a lot more interest in using domain-driven design, which is really has a really good fit with microservices and distributed architecture, and clean architecture, which is, you know, just the latest in a number of names for things like ports and adapters or hexagonal, or someone I know came up with this term called onion architecture at one point. Mm-hmm. You know, is related as well. Do you remember who that was? Who came up with that onion architecture name?
Yeah, thanks for the plug. Appreciate it. So there's a lot of developers out there who are in their first 10 years of programming. And let's just tackle the first bit, domain-driven design, before we get into clean architecture. And so if they're in their first 10 years, then they haven't heard all the discussions when domain-driven design first came out and why it's even important. And there's code samples out there. And so rather than get mistaken into thinking, oh, a particular code sample that I saw is domain-driven design, can you kind of level set, okay, what is it and what is it not? And what's the root of it all?
Sure. So domain-driven design is named for a book that was written by Eric Evans, came out in about 2004. It's almost 20 years old at this point as a term. And what it focuses on is the creating a model of the problem space in your software. So if you've learned object-oriented design and you want to be able to take a bunch of objects and use them to kind of model what's going on in your client's business or whatever the domain might be that they're working in, like that's what it's all about. And ostensibly, I mean, that's at least for me, when I first started learning about how to build software using objects. And sure, you can still build things with functional programming or other models, but DDD is mostly about object-oriented systems in my experience, right? There are folks doing it in functional, but let's just focus on OO for now. The whole idea was that you would be able to construct this model in your software of how something worked, and then, you know, be able to add inputs to it or make changes to it. And it would have these rules that would follow to give you the output. So to say that's not valid or things like that. And domain-driven design is like how to do that, how to take big, complicated problems in software and break them up into smaller pieces that we as developers can isolate, think about, design, test, and then, you know, construct together in a modular fashion with other pieces. And so that's really what it's all about, is breaking down big, complicated business problems into chunks that we can model in our software effectively.
Mm-hmm. And I'll admit, and I would say if anyone hadn't read that book, you should read the book. But that book changed my world, you know, a long time ago. But I have to admit, there's a lot of concepts in that book.
There really are. Yes.
So when you say, okay, domain-driven design, that a lot of concepts. Are there key concepts that you find applying more frequently than others? And what are all the concepts, just to kind of
trying to lay them all out is a lot. For folks that are listening that are interested, I have two different courses on this on Pluralsight that I did with Julie Lerman. One was like 10 years ago on .NET Full Framework, and then one like just a year and a half ago that's using .NET Core, .NET 5, I think, at the time. And they kind of cover the highlights of this and more than the minute and a half that I'm going to give it right now. The main things that you want to think about in DDD are, at the high level, sort of this language that you're going to use to describe the constructs in the problem domain. So you want to agree on the terminology of what you're talking about. So if you're in the room with the stakeholders, and some of them are talking about users, and some of them are talking about customers, and some of them are talking about accounts, but they all mean the same thing, right? You want to nail that down so everybody's talking about the same thing with the same language. And so that's called the ubiquitous language that you're going to use everywhere in your system. And then using that ubiquitous language, you're going to establish a context in which that makes sense, in which that language applies. And in a large company, there might be places where it makes sense to think of the person as a user, and somewhere else they think of them as a customer, and somewhere else they're dealing with an account. But for your one piece of software that you're building, you want to nail that down to just one of those things and use it consistently in that context. And you don't want that to bleed into other systems in your company. And so you want to have a bounded context. You want to have boundary around it that is like an encapsulation boundary, where if you do need to interact with other parts of the company or other partners, other companies, you have some way, you know, some boundary that you go through for that, like a set of APIs or services that you expose that do that. All right, so now you've got this bounded context. And inside that bounded context, you're going to create a model of the problem in software. And that model is going to be a bunch of classes and objects and types that you're going to build. And those are typically going to mainly comprise entities, which are things that have an identity and have some lifetime in your system, things you're going to store in a table and then look them up later. And then value objects, which are just ideas or concepts inside the model that don't have identity. Really easy ones to think about would be like a date time. You know, if I say that something is happening on August 15th of 2022, I don't have to put an ID on that, right? If you have another instance somewhere that's August 15th, 2022, it's the same thing because the properties match, and that's all a value object is. But it turns out that there's a whole lot of utility in modeling complex parts of your business software as value objects instead of just as, you know, a couple of ints or a couple of strings, and having these primitives. There's other types as well. A lot of times it's useful to use events inside your domain model. And so domain events is another thing that's frequently leveraged to help with some of the complexity in your design, but they're not required. And there's a number of other patterns and things that you'll use as well. But, you know, essentially it's a language. You're going to map the problem space to your solution space. That mapping is going to be applicable within a bounded context, and that's going to generate your domain model that's going to mainly consist of entities and value objects and maybe events and a few other things.
Do you remember why domain-driven design even came about? I don't remember, but there's so many people talking about it. But at the time, what's the alternative? If you say, no, I'm not using domain-driven design, I'm using...
Well, remember back in that time, you know, around 2003, 2004, I don't know when he started writing the book, but it was, you know, early 2000s, like a whole lot of the software development community was database first, right? Like that was how you built things.
Yeah.
And so if you were trying to write software in the 90s or the early 2000s, there was a good chance that the way you were thinking about the problem was SQL Server table schema. And the customer would come to you and they'd say, well, I need an online store with products and shopping carts and customers, and you'd be in your head thinking, well, I need a customer table and a product table and a cart table or whatever, right? And then you'd have these things to, you know, join them all together or whatever. And then you might write everything in stored procedures. Like, that was a thing in the 90s. And a lot of times you didn't have a choice. Like, you know, the DBA, you know, owned the database and wouldn't let you lowly developers have access to it, except maybe through stored procedures. And so there might be a bunch of stored procedures that would do all the logic. And the consequence of that was that your C# code or whatever language you were writing at the time, it didn't have a whole lot of your business logic solely inside your code. A lot of that business logic was in the database. It was in those stored procedures. And so it made it very difficult to test that type of software using automated testing, using unit tests. And so the only way you could test it was with an actual database that would, you know, do all the business logic and stored procedures. And those types of tests tended to be way more brittle and way more slow. And so as Agile took off and as TDD took off and folks wanted to be able to do automated testing quickly, we wanted to be able to have software that only ran in the software and wasn't tightly coupled to infrastructure like a database that had some of that logic in it.
Yeah, and I remember now there were database schemas and actually database connection strings shared by different departments frequently, which caused the definition of a customer over in the sales department to bleed all those extra properties into fulfillment that maybe weren't necessary, that were really lead generation and account management aspects of a customer that weren't necessary for figuring out how to ship something to a customer.
Exactly. And that's coming today. I mean, there's tons of companies today that only have one database. And they may have a lot of different applications, or they may have one big application that runs the company that has a whole lot of different pieces, right, that are all separate. But they all talk to the same database. And so you'll look at that database and you'll see some central thing that everybody talks to, like this account table, and it'll have like 90 columns on it. And the first 10 like make sense that everybody would need. And then the other 80 are all these nullable columns that, you know, somebody added over the years. And you can't change anything in one of those tables because everybody depends on it. But you can always add one more nullable column to the right. And so that's what happens.
Right, right. Let me ask you about bounded context, because I think that has a lot of confusion, especially with modern patterns that get talked about. If you're in one Visual Studio solution, does it automatically mean you're in one bounded context? And then if you're in a system with 10 different solutions across 10 different Git repositories, whether you're trying to go for microservices or just smaller applications, do you automatically have 10 different bounded contexts? Or is it not one for one with the number of Git repositories? And how do you think about that?
I think about it in terms of having a bounded context per application that you deploy. And so if I have, you know, an ASP.NET Core web application, that'll typically be one bounded context. Now, it might be that you ship a really large web application, right? If you're Facebook or Google or something, your one web application has a whole lot of stuff in it. And so you'd have multiple bounded contexts in there for sure. It is simpler if you can maintain having a one-for-one of an application that you ship with a bounded context. Now, how many Git repositories do you have? And whether you have a bunch of different applications in one Git repo, or like a mono repo, or if you have a whole bunch of different repos that all have, you know, every microservice is its own repo and you have to like get them all to stay in sync when they deploy. Like, those are different challenges, I think. But the simplest thing, especially if you're just learning about this stuff, is to say, I have one solution that deploys one application, and that one application has one bounded context. And so my domain model and everything applies to this one solution, this one application I'm building. And if I build another application, I'll build it with another solution and it'll have its own separate bounded context. And then how do I synchronize those two? Well, that's the challenge that you have. That's the opportunity that you have when you start following DDD, where if everything was in one database and your one database was your integration for all the things, you didn't have to think about it, right? If somebody updated their phone number, they updated their phone number for everybody. But if you have multiple different bounded contexts, each bounded context should have its own database, which I haven't mentioned yet, but that's a key point, right? Each bounded context should be responsible for its own data and its own state. And so if the, you know, customer calls into the, you know, I don't know, the accounting department and updates their phone number, the marketing team also wants to know that their phone number updated. And so since it's not one database to rule them all anymore, you have to have some means to propagate that change to those other systems that care. And typically you're going to use events for that.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that I remember, this is probably in the late 2000s, noticing how it changed how I thought about software and did analysis was the language. You mentioned ubiquitous language. But I remember mistakes like when we'd look at the, I don't know, the history of when something happened, and it would have a record that says Jane Smith opened her, you know, who opened the account on this particular date? Oh, it was Jane Smith. Well, okay, in the last year, you know, Jane got married. Now it's Jane Brown. So back in 2009, who opened the account? Jane Smith. But right. Without modeling that, we might say, oh, Jane Brown opened it in 2009. Well, she wasn't even married. She didn't change her name right. back in 2000. Right. And now we have these anomalies because of how we chose to model those concepts.
Yep. You see that kind of thing happen with addresses too, where someone naively designs a system with foreign keys for addresses and they say, oh, well, when the customer creates a new order, we're going to ship it to them. Well, the customer has a list of addresses. So there's address number 123. So instead of putting the address on the order, we'll just put, you know, a foreign key to say it's address number 123. And then mm-hmm. the customer moves and now they have a new address. And you go and look at the, you know, the updated address 123 to be their new address. And now all your order history is wrong. It says, oh, we shifted all to this other place. Like, no, you didn't. You shifted to the thing that was there before, but you've blown it away now because the customer updated their address and it literally updated record 123's values. And your order didn't store the historic record of where you actually shipped it. You stored a pointer to the customer's current address. And, you know, if they change that current address, then your order history is all wrong. That yeah. kind of design is super common.
Yeah. Normalizing too much.
Right.
Right. Thinking, yeah. oh, because I can normalize it, should I normalize?
Yeah, I don't want to have duplicate data. You know, storage is super expensive. Like, yeah, is it really in 2022? No, right. it's not. Yeah. So historical records of things should always be duplicate data. There should be a snapshot of the data at that time.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, for time, let's switch. There's no way we could do domain-driven design justice, but if I'd encourage the listeners, if you haven't just read the original book, start there. What would you say?
It's a good place to start. It's not an easy read. So if you're looking for something a little more approachable, Pluralsight course or some of Von Vernon's later books
that's right.
might be a little easier to get up to speed and then go to that book as the reference. And certainly it's a good book to have on your shelf behind you when you're on your Zoom meetings so people know that you know what you're talking about because you've got that big blue book behind you.
All right.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery. Clear Measure is also happy to be a sponsor of the video podcast, Programming with Palermo. Watch, learn, and program alongside Chief Architect Jeffrey Palermo. Videos are added weekly and available on syndicated locations supporting video podcast or by visiting palermo.network. Tune in today.
So let's switch gears to clean architecture. And this is one of the other big topics, but just start at the basic. What is it?
So the idea with clean architecture is just a way to separate the pieces that build up your application by concern, right? Just applying separation of concerns to your software. And the main concerns you typically have in software are the user interface, the business logic, and then like data access and other external system access you might have, like sending emails or calling web services or things like that. And so when I look at clean architecture, typically in a web app building with ASP.NET Core, there's going to be a web project that has all the ASP.NET Core stuff in it. And there's going to be a project that has just my business entities in it. And I typically call that core. Some people call it domain or domain model. But there's a project that is just the core domain model of the system. And it's got all those entities and value objects and stuff I talked about when we were discussing DDD. And then there's a third project that has all the things that talk to out-of-process concerns. And I call that infrastructure. And so the infrastructure project has your data access stuff in it. It's got your entity framework or your Dapper or whatever you're using is in there. If you're talking to Azure services or AWS services, all those adapters are in infrastructure. If you're sending emails or anything like that, that the implementation details are in infrastructure. And what this lets you do is ensure that none of those implementation details ever leak into your business model. And the way you do that is through the magic of project references. So in Visual Studio and in .NET, when you have a project reference, the compiler will make sure that you don't have a circular reference or circular dependency. And so that infrastructure project that has all those implementations is going to reference the core project, the business logic project. And because all your infrastructure concerns reference the core business logic project, there's no way for the opposite to be true. There's no way for the core to ever reference all that stuff that's database specific or cloud vendor specific or whatever, right? So your implementation details never end up leaking into your business model, which keeps them very clean and easy to test.
I remember the book entitled Clean Architecture by Robert Martin. Did that term start with him, or is it, where did this notion come from on the umbrella?
I think he popularized it. Yeah, I would say he probably popularized it with that book title. Because like I said, it's gone by other names like ports and adapters, hexagonal, or onion architecture that are all essentially the same idea.
Okay. And I don't know exactly where clean architecture originated, but I remember reading that book and what hit me, and tell me, because again, I think this is maybe one of these concepts where there's a lot in there. He talked about looking at the code base of a piece of software and knowing what the software did. Like when you look at blueprints of a library, it looks like a library versus a church.
Yep.
How do you think of that?
Yeah, he has an article somewhere, maybe it's a chapter in that book called Screaming Architecture, where like if you look at the code, it should just scream what it is to you. And that I think mostly comes down to how you name some of the folder structure and stuff inside of it. So if you look at like a typical template that Microsoft ships for any of their projects, right, they don't have any idea what you're building. So if you say, give me a new MVC project, it's going to have folders like models, controllers, view models, and those don't tell you anything about what it is you're actually doing because they have no idea, right? But 99% of developers out there just stick with that, and that's what they use because it's the template, right? But there's been, I don't know, 10 years ago or even earlier, a big push to start using things like feature folders and other things where you name stuff according to what it actually is. Instead of having a controllers folder, you know, if you're building a store, you know, maybe you've got folders for things like, you know, catalog and checkout and things like that as top level features in the project. And that, I think, is more what Robert Martin's talking about when he's talking about screaming architecture, is like name the folders, name the structural components inside the solution structure according to the actual features of what you're building. And that applies whether you're in the web project or the infrastructure project or even in the core business model. And so a lot of times, like when you're doing a DDD type template, you might have a core project that starts out with folders for things like entities and value objects and domain events. And again, those don't tell you anything about what you're building. You are, as the actual implementer, it's your job to take those generic terms and make them feature specific. You know, make it so you have specific folders for, you know, the customer aggregate or the, you know, whatever the features are in your domain. And don't just stick with the generic ones that make it less obvious what things are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned an infrastructure project, and I've encountered this over time where, if you're talking to a database, great, you got your ORM, you got your entity framework in there, but how do you think about having one infrastructure project where you have all these dependencies versus multiple?
I think it's start with one, and if you see value in having multiple, it's fine. So for me, I usually have one. And it'll have a data folder in it. And inside of data, there's going to be any framework or Dapper or whatever I'm doing for data access. And then it will have other folders for things like, you know, talking to other APIs or sending emails or whatever it might be. If I'm a large organization and maybe I have a standard way that I'm going to send emails, you know, I've got a microservice that we use for sending emails. It's common use case for a microservice. Maybe I just ship a NuGet package that has everything you need to know on how to talk to the company's microservice that sends emails. And instead of having a library or a folder inside of infrastructure, you just have a NuGet reference to it, you know, for that. If you want to have infrastructure be broken up into, you know, product name dot data access and product name dot email and product name dot cloud or whatever, right? That's fine. The important thing is that all of those infrastructure specific projects still depend on your core project, on your domain model. But it doesn't really matter to me whether you have multiple projects or not. I just don't start with that because why add more projects than necessary? I already get people that push back on me and say, oh, clean architecture is too complicated. It's got three projects. Like, really? Yeah, three is too much for you? All right.
Well, and specifically, what are those review? What are the names of those three typically in your, like, what names do you like?
Core, infrastructure, and web.
Web, okay. And so what, web references core and core references infrastructure?
Web references core and usually also infrastructure, and infrastructure references core. Core doesn't reference anything.
Okay, so let me devil's advocate on it. So you got some business logic, some code in core that needs some data.
Mm-hmm.
You got to reference infrastructure, right?
Uses an abstraction for that, right? So it'll use an interface that's defined in core to do it. So if I have some, let's say, domain service that needs to know how to like transfer money from this account to that account, and it needs to look up the data for both those accounts and check their balances and do whatever, right? So it might have some, you know, iAccount repository or iAccount service in there that it has a method on it that says how to fetch that record. And I use that interface in that service in core to do all that work. Now, do I care? And all the business logic about how to check that balance and make sure it's not negative and wrap it all in a transaction, whatever. Like, do I care if that's actually talking to SQL Server or if it's talking to, you know, Azure Table Storage? No, I don't care. That's not relevant to the business logic. But then in infrastructure, I will implement that interface and it will talk to SQL Server or it will talk to Access or it will talk to whatever and do the work of actually communicating to the ultimate persistent store.
I think that's one of the big ideas in software design. Is the direction of that reference.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's applying the dependency inversion principle.
For the listeners out there who don't, Steve and I have been friends for a long time. We've talked about this, but I know there's no point of contention here. That's one of the big ideas is not have just cascading references down all the way to a database or whatever else external that you're talking to.
Right.
Because then you actually have core project or whatever you want to call it. It has a chance of not having spaghetti code mangled with all these other dependency libraries.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And I know we're preaching to each other's choir here, right? But yeah, it's like all these dependencies are transitive. And so if your business logic depends on infrastructure and your infrastructure depends on the database, then guess what? All your business logic now depends on the database because of that transitive dependency nature. So the only way to avoid that is to make it so that the business logic doesn't depend on any of that other stuff. Make all that other stuff depend on it. And again, that's the solid principle of dependency inversion principle is how you apply that. And with modern frameworks, it's never been easier to do that. With .NET Core has dependency injection support built in from day one. You know, it's really easy. In fact, it's just the expected way that you're going to build things is to use dependency injection and facilitate that type of system where you're depending on interfaces, not depending on concrete types.
You mentioned some people have objected saying, hey, that's too complicated. What about the others? And I've encountered this. Where they say, splitting up all these projects, it's not necessary. Why? Why go through the trouble? You know, they don't classify right. It, oh, it's too complicated. They're just like, for what purpose? Why? I know where everything is. I know not to, I can keep it separated. It's called namespaces.
Sure. Yeah. Or folders, right? I could just build it in a web project. I could have all my entities in a folder in the web project. I could have all my DB contacts in another folder in the web project. It doesn't have to have separate projects. This is adding constraints, right? And some folks chafe at constraints. They think, I don't need constraints. The constraints get in my way. I'm too good at this to need these guardrails. And to those people, I always ask, like, great, so you don't use like methods or scoping of variable names? You don't use private versus public on any of your classes? Everything is just declared in the global space? Like, all those things are constraints, right? Having scoping of our variables is a constraint that's not necessary. You could do your whole program with global state if you wanted to. And I haven't met anyone yet that does that. So I think they're okay with some constraints. And so the constraint here is that we're leveraging the dependency relationship that we can't have a circular dependency to kind of force us into the pit of success and make it so that you can't accidentally or on purpose have some business object that, you know, news up a DB context and goes and grabs the data it needs. Why not? Because the DB context is in a project that references that business object's project. And so there is no way for it to do that. Now, if you had all that stuff in one web project and they were just in different folders, there would not be that protection. You would be able to just, you know, new up a DB context anywhere you want, whether it's the right place or the wrong place or whatever, and grab whatever data you need. And some developers feel like that's what they should be able to do. Like, I know what I'm doing. If I need some data, I'm going to go get my data right here. You know, I think that tends to lead you down into problems that you would be better off avoiding.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's so many ways of encapsulation, so many other constraints. Yeah, why don't you make everything public? What I've encountered is the people who make those statements typically are the more senior, more capable programmers. And you could say, okay, do they individually need these constraints? Could they function without them? Well, yes.
Yeah.
But when you get into a team environment.
And they probably do every day.
Yeah. But when you get into the team environment, it really helps everyone to not have IntelliSense suggesting to you right in your face things that are really not appropriate to use in a particular type.
Right.
Because IntelliSense will suggest whatever it can get to.
It reminds me of a book called The Checklist Manifesto. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it basically talks about doctors using checklists to make sure they don't forget things, and pilots and other people too. But one of the things that I took away from that is they, the authors did a survey of doctors that had done this, had tried using a checklist or not. And overall, they'd seen like an improvement in the care, the overall care from the doctors that use the checklist. And so they asked the doctors, would you use a checklist now, seeing the benefits of this? And it was like, yeah, like 50% or 60% said, sure, I'll do it. And then this follow-up question was like, if you were getting surgery, would you want the doctor that was doing surgery on you to follow this checklist? Like 95% said yes. So like, yeah, you're super confident in your own abilities, but you know, this isn't just about you. Like, yeah, in the team environment or for, or some other new hire, like, do you want them to have these constraints that are going to help them do the right thing?
Yeah, that's a great point. Very mature and high stakes other professions have chosen to put constraints on themselves and with positive effect.
Yep.
So that's a great point. That's a great point. Well, as we close up here, again, both of these topics, you know, you can't do it justice with, but you've got specifically, what courses do you have available on Pluralsight?
The ones that relate to this are Solid Principles for C# Developers, and Pluralsight has a DDD Fundamentals course that, again, there's two versions of. So if you're still using full framework .NET, we've got you covered. If you're on .NET Core, the latest one is using that. And it has a very extensive sample application. So even if you don't have Pluralsight access, go to my GitHub. I'm Ardalis Online, A-R-D-A-L-I-S. So just go to github.com/Ardalis and you'll find the Pluralsight DDD code there. And it has three separate applications that communicate using a message queue between them. And each one has a different bounded context with a different model. I went way overboard on architecting the demo for that course. So it's, but it's all out there if folks want to see it and use it. Even if they aren't a Pluralsight subscriber, they can go grab it off GitHub.
Okay, nice.
Other than that, my latest course was on ASP.NET Core 6 Web API Best Practices. And that just dropped about a month ago. So people can check that out if they're building APIs.
Very cool. And you also have updated your book for Microsoft, Architecting Web Applications, Modern Web Applications with .NET 6.
That's right.
That's the latest update.
Yeah. So I've got a free ebook. You download it as a PDF, or you can even read it just online in your browser. The easiest way to find it is to Google eShop on web. And so there's a Microsoft reference application called eShop on web. It's out on GitHub. The book is a companion to that reference application. And so I update it pretty much every October or so with the next version of .NET coming in November. And it's about 100 pages or so. It's a quick read, but it introduces you to some DDD concepts and things like clean architecture, separation of concerns, and kind of shows how to apply all that in .NET, again, with that reference application that you can grab for free.
Yeah, awesome. And as we close, we mentioned devbetter.com and you do some career coaching. What type of person tends to be interested in the DevBetter program?
Yeah. So DevBetter, I started a few years ago. I think it's going on 4 years now. If you join, you have access to a Discord server where you talk all the time. And then we do like a coaching call every week for about an hour where we just answer questions and discuss things. You have access to all the recordings of all the coaching calls and you can search for different topics. But we have a variety of different folks at different levels of their career. We have some folks that feel like they've been in software for 15 or 20 years and they feel like they haven't they kind of stagnated. They want to go to the next level. They want to, you know, get that next job that's going to really excite them. We have others that are like in a, you know, developer role and they really want to get to that senior developer role. And they're like asking questions about, well, what does it take to be a senior developer? How can I convince my boss that I should be a senior developer? And so we talk about those types of things a lot. So we cover things like personal branding and how to be building content that helps people find you, interviewing skills and, you know, tips for how to get an interview, how to succeed in your interview. And we have members that have been with the group for like 3 or 4 years now that are alumni that have basically graduated from it, but they're still participating and they have a lot to share as well. So it's not just me and my experience, but it's this broader network of people that are kind of sharing their experience in the group.
Nice. Is it free to join or a subscription fee?
It's a subscription. And so it's, you join the first 2 years are paid. And then if you decide to stick around after that, you can be an alumni member, which currently is free. At some point I might charge some nominal amount for alumni if it gets to be too big or something. But as of now, all the alumni members are free and they can just stick around forever.
Nice. Nice. Awesome. Well, Steve, hey, thanks for coming back on the podcast and sharing with us about domain-driven design and clean architecture. It's huge topics, but we'll include everything we talked about in the show notes. So appreciate you coming back on.
Awesome. Yeah, it was great catching up with you again.
Oh, my pleasure. And until next time, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.